Like to welcome you all here today. It's such an extreme honor for us to have Dr. Kenneth Cook with us, who will be addressing pain associated with gastroparesis and from other potential causes. For those unfamiliar with Association of Gastrointestinal Motility Disorders, or AGMD, we're a nonprofit international organization, and we serve as an integral educational resource for GI motility diseases and disorders. We also function as an important information clearinghouse for members of the medical, scientific, and nutritional communities. And of course, we provide a form of support for patients and their families suffering from GI motility diseases and disorders. And for those of you who do not know me, my name is Mary Angela DeGrazia Tucci. I'm a longtime patient with SUTE obstruction that has progressed to include gastroparesis. My whole esophagus is affected, and I have a host of other medical problems. But I also serve, most importantly, as a volunteer for AGMD. With us here today and assisting with the program is Melissa Adams Van Houten. She not only is the gastroparesis patient, but she's a gastroparesis group creator and administrator, and is our public policy and outreach director. Melissa, can you introduce yourself?
Well, that was a pretty thorough introduction. Yeah, my name is Melissa Adams Van Houten. I've had gastroparesis for almost 7 years. I was diagnosed in February of 2014, and I run a set of online patient support and advocacy groups, and as Ms. Mary Angela said, serve as the public policy and outreach director for the AGMD.
Perfect. During the first part of the program, we ask that you hold off on asking questions because we have reserved the second part specifically for that reason, and the Melissa Adams Van Houten will be leading that question and answer part of the program. So thank you, Melissa, for your willingness to do that. Dr. Cook, again, we're so honored to have you with us today. So we're going to be focusing on this hot topic, which is pain associated with gastroparesis, but also other causes. So let's get right to the point. Why is it that some patients experience pain with gastroparesis? Dr. Cook?
All right. Good morning, everybody, and thank you for listening in. You know, I'm a gastroenterologist here at Wake Forest University. I've been interested in gastroparesis and what is nausea and vomiting for many years. And so the pain, many of you, most of my patients will say they have some type of pain with their nausea and their fullness symptoms. And I make a hard stop right there. I think it's very important to separate pain from these other symptoms. And I will say something like, well, what do you mean? What do you want to tell me about the pain? Because you see, if I can figure out what's driving the pain, that might be the answer to the other symptoms, the nausea that comes with the pain, the sweating, the weakness, who knows, the vomiting. So if there's a pain component, we need to get to the bottom of that pain, because guess what? It might not be coming from the gastroparesis that you've been told you have. It may be coming from some other non-stomach, even non-digestive cause. And we can get into this a little bit, Mary Angela, because this is really important that the patient and the doctor understand the pain.
The pain. Talking about the pain, some patients with gastroparesis, they describe it as cramping, while others say it's a dull pain. Some say it's a constant pain. Some say it's just random pain. And still, some patients experience acute or sharp pain. Does this type of pain and severity give any clues to the gastroparesis and or the treatment?
Yeah, sure can. So as you are, it's crucial to describe the various attributes of the pain as you've done. And each of you listening, if you have a pain, here's what I learned as a medical student, and I still teach all the time. And that is, when somebody, like a patient, tells me they have pain, that doesn't tell me much at all. And so I think of PQRST. Okay, PQRST, what does that stand for? Where the P is for pain, the Q is for the quality of the pain. So I do need to know, is it burning? That can mean acid or nerve. Is it cramping? That sounds like a muscle cramp, like a menstrual cramp, a uterine cramp, a GI cramp. Let's see, what else is there? Dull, sharp. There aren't that many words. So P, Q, the quality. R, what does R stand for? Radiation. Does it radiate anywhere? This pain, it's dull and it's in my upper abdomen. It goes straight to my back. Big, it just shoots right to my mid back. That makes me think of pancreas, not stomach. Or that pain goes from my belly button, I don't know, to my, lower abdomen. But anyway, the point is, does it radiate? What if it radiated from my right side up to my shoulder? Is that gallbladder? So PQR radiation. S, severity. Are you talking about a pain that is, 9 out of 10 and I'm close to going to the ED, or is this a 1 or a 2? So I try to get a severity score. And then really important is timing. Timing means what is the timing of the pain? I have patients who are no pain until, 5 minutes into their meal. I have patients who have no pain until they twist to reach something. It's movement-induced pain. So some patients have pain at night that wakes them up. So what is the timing? So you see how you have to dig into it. So you could each think of the pain that you're talking about, and help the doc by saying, by understanding, it may be helpful to figure out what's driving that pain, to go over the PQRST.
Well, I think that's great because oftentimes patients are given that pain score 1 through 10. Some patients have a high threshold for pain tolerance, and others not so much. And I hear a lot of frustration because what somebody's number three might be is another person's seven. So by delving into it more so, and that's a general thing. I don't know how many patients have had that happen. I have had that happen numerous times, but delving into it, I think it's so important instead of just looking at that pain score and going, there it is, or seeing a
Well,
smiley face or the next faces that go in sequence to determine what that pain level is.
and so, pain also in motility disorders might have to be differentiated from discomfort. So in the pain world, pain means, you feel like there's some tissue destruction about to happen. When you hit your thumb with a hammer, man, that's a 10 out of 10, and it really hurts, and you've probably damaged some tissue. That's one kind of pain. I'll have patients that say, "Well, I have this pain," and they're not wincing, they're not doubled over in pain. And I say, "Well, tell me about the pain." And they'll say, "Well, it's this, I kind of feel pressure and there's this bloating, distension." And I say, "Well, is that your pain?" And they say, "Yeah, that's what I'm talking about." But you see the difference? And so if the doc doesn't get into that, they're thinking pain in some, you may not be communicating on the same page. when you talk about pain. So patients will say, yeah, you know, you're right. What I'm trying to tell you about, what's so uncomfortable for me? What is so nasty is this bloating distension. Yeah, it's not really a pain. It's bad, but do you see, does that little differential make a difference?
It does. Yeah. I think it really, really does.
And here's why I say that, because, you know, if it's a pain, quote unquote, and you go through the PQRST, then this will help the doctor come up with the all important differential diagnosis. They have to be thinking about not the obvious, but the one, two, or three things after the obvious. And that's a differential diagnosis, and you have to collect some information to get into that. So there you are. How do you proceed, yeah. Mary Angela? What would you like? So what do you all would like to think of next as the doctor's thinking about your pain, your discomfort?
So that's how you bring up the conversation. That's how you facilitate it with your patients. But there are still some doctors who don't even believe that gastroparesis pain exists. And so it's really hard to communicate to those doctors who don't facilitate the conversation as you do. Do you have any suggestions for the patient?
Yeah, so I think other than the PQRST, that each person can think about if they have a pain or a discomfort, think about those things. But here's a physiologic way to think about the stomach and gastroparesis. Let's start with physiologic. So when we get hungry, and you may not be all that hungry when you have gastroparesis, but when you ingest food into your stomach, the stomach is now faced with a challenge. It has to begin to work. So many patients who have gastroparesis begin to feel bad after they eat, right? That's the early satiety, the fullness. There may be bloating. There may be discomfort to pain, right? After that meal is in the stomach. Because as we've talked before, the stomach must begin to first relax to receive the food. It has to stretch. It has to relax. And it has to get into that mixing motion. That requires an electrical rhythm, a normal electrical rhythm, just like the heart, but it has to have a normal rhythm to mix and empty that food. That's real work. That's work of the muscle and the neurons and the pacemaker system of the stomach. Well, guess what? Guess what other organs are called upon to work when you ingest that meal? Well, number one, the gallbladder. The gallbladder is called upon to begin to empty its bile into the duodenum, because if there's a little bit of fat or a little bit of some sort of, you all probably don't eat that much fat or fried food, but you know, the gallbladder for any meal is called upon to work. The pancreas is called upon to work and make ounces of pancreatic juice that have to come out into the duodenum to continue the digestion of that meal. Blood flow is diverted from, you know, your biceps and your thighs to your stomach and your digestive tract. You need blood flow. And then pretty soon the small bowel has to start working, and even the colon gets involved, because there might be an urge to have a bowel movement. Wow. That's a lot of different organs that have been called into play once you put food in your stomach. So what does that mean for patients with gastroparesis? Well, it means number one, yeah, that discomfort, that pain may be coming from the stomach, but my gosh, if I have a patient who still has their gallbladder, I say, you know, interesting, you have upper abdominal discomfort, you've got some bloating, some nausea, maybe some pain after you eat. You know, why couldn't this be your gallbladder? I have patients who have both a gallbladder problem. The gallbladder fails to empty. The gallbladder may have some tiny stones, but you may have both gallbladder disease and gastroparesis. So guess what? You know, if you find that out, you may have to remove the gallbladder and see what portion of those postprandial symptoms were due to gallbladder. If there's a pancreas possibility, you know, there's ultrasound, there's CAT scan, there's blood tests to see if that's an issue. We see a lot of patients with small bowel bacterial overgrowth. You know, maybe 20, 30 minutes after the meal, there's those same symptoms that you're blaming on the stomach could actually be due to small bowel bacterial overgrowth. But do you see what I'm getting at here? You have to, I call it divide and conquer. There's a lot of organs in there. And so you want to make sure that your main symptoms are due to the stomach, to poor motility of the stomach. So, Angela, that's kind of how I think, you know, that's how the doctor should think about it. There are these other possibilities. These symptoms can be quite similar, actually, and can fool you. So you have to do testing. When I see patients, I sometimes say, wow, that could be, and by the way, I didn't even talk about GERD. You know, a lot of, my gosh, 80%, 85, 95% of our, 90% of our patients with gastroparesis have acid reflux. And sometimes acid reflux is atypical. It can be more of a discomfort in the epigastrium. It may or may not burn. There can be nausea. And what portion of those symptoms after one eats is actually due to an atypical form of acid reflux? So sometimes to work this all out, I'll mention to folks, we need to get you a six pack. Mary Angela, do you know what a six pack is?
I thought I did, but apparently I don't.
So I said, my gosh, you have been on, you know, 12 different drugs. You've seen three doctors and we don't know what you have. You may have gastroparesis, but I mean, really, this would be the kind of aggressive or thorough workup. I might have to get esophageal manometry and pH to see, are we being fooled? Is this an atypical GERD? For the stomach, I get a gastric emptying study, and it must be the four-hour egg beaters. That's the classic. It can't be grits. It can't be oatmeal. We still depend on that four-hour gastric emptying. But, you know, I also hear in several places around the country will get an electrogastrogram that looks at the stomach's electrical rhythm. But importantly, it looks at the rhythm as the stomach does work, but the work it does, the patient ingests water over a 5-minute period till they're completely full. So that might be 8 ounces, 12 ounces, whatever volume gets the patient completely full, that's what the stomach has to work on, and we see what the electrical rhythm is. So that's four tests. I'll say we need to do a breath test for bacterial overgrowth, and if they still have their gallbladder, that could be an ultrasound or a gallbladder emptying. So that's a 6 or 7 pack to look at each of those organs from a physiologic standpoint. You know, I didn't even talk about endoscopy. Endoscopy is the last thing I do. because most of my patients have had it, but I still want to get that at some point. So do you see, it's not easy actually to be sure which of those organs that are called into action after eating are the principal problem, the principal problem. And so I like to be sure it's the stomach, and I can be sure it's the stomach if I make sure I'm treating or addressing these other possibilities. Does that make sense?
It does. And I will never think of a six pack the same way again.
Okay. Well, you know, so that's why when I see somebody who says, I'm coming to see you because I have nausea and gastroparesis, actually happened yesterday, a fellow who's been all over. And I said, well, that's, you've got all these tests and they've done this and that. And I said, well, tons of records. And I said, well, guess where I start? He said, I don't know, where do you start? And I held up a blank piece of paper. I said, this is where I start. I'm listening to you, and now I'm going to listen to your symptoms and then design this workup based on really what I just told you all to try to figure out which of several things or multiple things are the problems so we can address them from a physiologic, pathophysiologic viewpoint with real data, objective data, by the way. So that's, it's complicated. You know, there's a lot of organs in that little space of the abdomen. And just to quickly pivot on that, what if you were my patient and you said, well, yeah, you know, eating bothers it, but my gosh, when I twist to the right, or I try to pick something up, or I cough, it really, really hurts right here in my upper abdomen. Well, that's totally different, isn't it? You talk about timing. This is a movement-related pain. But it is a pain in the abdomen, and it can fool people where that pain is coming from. And some of my patients actually have that pain on top of everything else. Anybody want to guess? Anybody want to raise their hand and tell me what that pain is from?
Hernia.
What's that?
Hernia. Liver.
A hernia. Okay. Yeah. It could be an abdominal hernia. You know, if you've had a surgery and a scar, that hernia, well, it could be a fresh hernia and it's causing pain, or it could be a repaired hernia that's now causing trouble. Guess how I guess, I bet I send two or three people almost a week to our pain clinic. And here's why. Because the pain clinic does not know anything about gastroparesis. They don't know anything about, you know, gallbladder. But here's why I send them. When I examine a patient, I look for old scars on the abdomen. And one of the most common causes of abdominal pain that I find is at the sites where they put the so-called trocar through the abdominal wall. And it could be a year ago or 3 years ago or 5 years ago. And when I ask patients, you know, they're laying on the exam table, and I say, well, would you point to where this pain is? We've been talking about this pain after you eat, or this pain after you vomit, or this pain, you know, when you move, where is it? Well, you know, it's amazing how they will, and I'll say, use your fingertip, and the finger will, you know, rise over the abdomen. It waits a moment, and it descends, guess where? Directly on the old scar. Directly. And I say, oh, let me put my finger there. And do you know that frequently I can, for better or for worse, I'll say, well, I'm pushing on it. What's that pain right now? And they'll say, oh, it's about a 5. And I say, well, is that your pain that we've been talking about? And they'll say, yes, or it's part of the pain. And then guess what I have them do? I have them raise their head off the exam table to actually contract those abdominal muscles. Remember I said abdominal muscles, that's where my six pack, oh, that's another six pack, by the way. the six pack is getting confusing, but you know what a six pack is. This is a different six pack, but those are abdominal muscles. When they contract that muscle, with my finger on that scar, the pain will go from a 5 to a 9. And they say, oh my gosh, not only does it hurt, it's radiating nausea. It's radiating nausea. And that's a very important physical finding, because that tells me at least part of their pain is not in the digestive system, it's in the abdominal wall. And that's called an abdominal wall syndrome. Scars can, as they heal, they can get neurons in there, there's inflammation in there. And that's a very important non-stomach cause. In fact, it's a non-digestive system cause of abdominal pain that can confuse everybody. Has anybody, have you heard of that particular scenario?
Have not, but what type of surgery would cause that?
Any kind, absolutely. Any time you go through the abdominal wall and are in the abdomen operating, when the surgeon pulls that out and puts a couple stitches in there, and it heals over time, any kind of injury like that can eventuate in that scar tissue becoming extremely tender, exquisitely tender. It's not pus. It's a chronic inflammation of the neurons as they grow into that healing scar. So most common would be the Nissen. I mean, would be the laparoscopic cholecystectomy. 60% of my patients have already had their gallbladders out. So you
and I have too. So this can be related to that.
If those, if you have tenderness, pain right at the scar, then yes, that is a potentially. By the way, that putting your finger on it, making it hurt, then raising your head, it's called a Carnet sign. Capital CARNETTS, Carnet sign. It's a physical exam that Dr. Carnet described in a paper he wrote in 1926. I was not born then. but I can tell you that classic paper is rediscovered about every 15 years, you know, and somebody writes about it. But most, it's amazing. It's amazing how many patients never have their abdomen examined for that. It could be anytime they put that trocar in there, they put 4 or 5 in. So the pain can be right, left, it can be right upper quadrant, left upper quadrant, wherever the trocar goes in. So a Nissen fundoplication is done that way now. But I would say gallbladder and Nissen are the most common.
What is Nissen? I think I've heard of that before.
Well, so a Nissen fundoplication is the operation that's done for acid reflux or GERD.
So Dr. Cook, you've talked about the different types. You have the type of pain, the intensity, the duration, when it occurs. I'm just going to deviate for a little bit and then I'm going to pull it back. But can you talk a little bit about, because you had this particular patient pointing to the part of the body that was the pain. But you also have a diagram, is that correct, that you use for patients?
Yeah, oh yeah, that diagram is, I should probably send it to you if you like, but that was more for nausea, because, you know, nausea and pain often go together. And they should. They're both warning systems that something's wrong. But, you know, nausea is even trickier to find what's driving nausea. And because many, many years ago, I was having such trouble with one patient, I just could not figure out her nausea. I finally said, well, where is your nausea? Like, where is it? And, you know, she basically said, oh, well, it's here. And she pointed way below her belly button, you know, almost in the suprapubic area. I said, wait, your nausea is like down there? Because in my mind, you know, nausea should be up in the upper abdomen. Well, that reminded me that she actually had a lot of irritable bowel. We never really addressed it. She had cramps and pellet-like stools and nausea. And we spent the next, I don't know, 6 months really getting her colon working, her colon better. And as that became more normal, you know, this nausea sensation she had in the lower abdomen, you know, basically resolved. So it led me to understand that, you know, colon dysfunction can also cause nausea. But that particular diagram, I'll occasionally say, well, show me where your pain is on there. But it's kind of a nausea helper, nausea locator, because nausea is such a diffuse, strange symptom. Pain, people can kind of locate more typically. So that's the sort of diagram you might have been referring to.
Yes. Why would pain, and I don't even know if there's an answer to this, but so many of patients who have the gastroparesis and other motility disorders, their symptoms vary from moment to moment. So why would the pain vary depending on either what they eat or just even how they're feeling for the day or at that moment? Why is it that it varies? Is there an answer to that?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think it does bring us back to, well, let's say you ruled out the gallbladder. It's not the pancreas. You got the irritable bowel as best you can control it. The heartburn is under control with acid medicines. And so now you're back to the stomach. You really do think the stomach is causing the satiety, the fullness, and the even the discomfort or pain. So here's why a lot of doctors don't think the stomach can cause pain, in my opinion. You know, gastroparesis sounds like the stomach's paralyzed. Gastroparesis sounds like the stomach is a floppy, weak, paralyzed thing, right?
Yes.
That's what paralysis sounds like to most people. So where's the pain coming from? I thought everything was sort of like not working. And so I always look for other things first that are causing pain after somebody eats who may or may not have gastroparesis. So but that being said, I think there's two ways that a gastroparesis stomach can have pain. One, and neither are, there's data on these things. It just hasn't got to the mainstream or we haven't got good drugs either. But one, the easy one, is the pylorus. The pylorus, remember, is this strong valve. It's a sphincter. The stomach is really associated with two sphincters, the lower esophageal sphincter and the pyloric sphincter. The lower esophageal sphincter has to open to let the food in. The pyloric sphincter at the end of the stomach has to open to let the food out. Well, we have found a series of a kind of a subtype of gastroparesis that has pyloric spasm. So now, if that pyloric valve doesn't open, it's too tight, maybe it's cramping, there's a pain. And the pylorus, you know, located, it'd be like to the right of your belly button. It's right up there by the gallbladder. And if that is part of your gastroparesis, you know, you eat and you have some discomfort. It's vague. It can be severe sometimes. It might depend on how much food you ate, the volume, maybe how much fat was in it. And it might sound exactly like gallbladder. And so for one reason or another, maybe there's a stone in there, maybe there's not. Nobody knows what to do. So the gallbladder is removed. And guess what? It doesn't help. It doesn't help because the gallbladder wasn't the problem. It's more subtle than that, and that is the pylorus. So we look at the patient's electrical rhythm. If it's normal and they have pain and they can't empty, we've actually work on the pylorus. And the pylorus right now is a high interest to the NIH and our gastroparesis research consortium. There are a lot of people just cutting the pylorus. I really don't like that. You really be careful about destroying the pylorus. But you know, if we think that's a bit of an outflow problem because of that valve, we use balloons to dilate it. We put Botox in there, and you know, when it works and that's the right diagnosis, people have less pain over there, less discomfort after they eat. So I think the pylorus is in some people, maybe 20%, maybe it'll be more. That is something to be addressed. The other kind of pain you can have is this. Remember I talked about drinking water till you're completely full? Healthy, control subjects will drink almost 20 ounces on average, and you know, in 5 minutes. So the stomach is filling up. You know, it's just filling up like a very sophisticated balloon or a wineskin. Mary Angela, do you know what a wineskin is?
Oh, I'm Italian. I do.
Oh.
Have you tell me, really?
What's your definition of a
wineskin? Excuse me. Excuse me. I'm sorry, continue. I couldn't hear you.
Well, anyway, think of it as sort of a sort of bladder-like thing that can be gently filled. Well, guess what? A healthy person, the stomach gently fills 20 ounces, and they feel full. That's it. You feel full. But guess what? My patients, I have patients who will drink literally 4 ounces or 8 ounces. And not only are they full, but they have discomfort. They have nausea. And you see, to me, that's about that stomach has forgotten how to relax. That muscle is too tight. And the water or the food, you know, is hitting those walls. The walls don't stretch. It's like non-compliant. And so there's discomfort just with the stretch of the wall. So this is something that some docs who are into this might do gabapentin. They might do muscle. They might do nitroglycerin. We have very few drugs to relax the stomach wall. This is also, I would say, kind of state of the art, but that to me are the two reasons you could get discomfort pain after eating and still have gastroparesis. And so to continue my neurology analysis, you can have two kinds of paralysis. You have the loose, flaccid, you know, my arm won't even, it's a floppy noodle. That's a paralysis, isn't it? But there's also a spastic paralysis. Perhaps you've seen these patients. Their arm is so contracted, so tight, it can't move. It's just as paralyzed as the floppy one. So I think in some patients, the stomach is indeed floppy and it fills up. But many others, it's too tight. And that can cause discomfort after you eat. You can't eat much. And then the pylorus. Those are my two main targets for stomach pain. in somebody with gastroparesis.
And so the variability would be whatever they're eating. It could be the yes. ingredients or the amount that they've eaten that day.
Absolutely.
Is that correct? Or even the day before, however their stomach is working. And even if they're feeling okay when they begin to eat, it can happen. Or after they eat, they're feeling pretty good, but it can happen even at night after they've eaten. So there might be a big delay in that pain.
Well, a couple of things there. And I think we'll probably want to do a session at some point on the diet, because most patients, you know, they figure this out. You know, they say, oh, you know, I ate, you know, literally 2 ounces too much, and I know it. I know I should have stopped. I am bloated, in pain, nauseated. I may well vomit. So that stomach has been stretched too much, perhaps. And when we do our water load, sometimes I'll say, you know, look, you drank till you were completely full, and you literally drank, you know, 120 ml, 4 ounces or 6 ounces. I said, you know, that's probably your stomach's volume limit. So, you know, I can chow down. I can put, you know, 30 ounces. I can, my stomach will really relax. Yours won't. So every 2 hours, this is why you learn this, every 2 or 3 hours, you have small volumes, because your stomach won't stretch. It won't stretch and it won't empty. So a lot of patients learn this. You know, we have like a three-step diet. It goes from, you know, just trying to stay hydrated with bouillon and Gatorade, to smoothies, to soups, you know, to starches. And it's the food that's easy for the weak stomach to mix and empty. But there's always a, you know, six little meals a day thing, because most patients, at least many of them, don't. Their stomachs forgot how to relax and receive the food by volume.
Yes. Well, I'm looking at the clock, so I just want to ask one more question before I put the program over to Melissa so she can present the question part of the program from the audience. But what are the other options available for patients with pain associated? What are the treatments, pain treatments, any other alternatives, treatments, anything that might be available for patients with pain?
Yeah, so I think when they've ruled out all the organs I mentioned, and there is no Carnot sign, and there's nothing else, you're convinced it's from the stomach. Now we look at perhaps the volume of water you were able to, we might work on that. And I might use something like, by the way, there's no specific medicine for this. So I'll try things like antispasm medicines, like dicyclamine or Bentyl or Levsin. I might even, those are muscle relaxers. I might try nitrates, you know, nitroglycerin, Isardil. Those are muscle relaxers. I think we need to have a whole, you know, nobody studies this. Nobody's, actually the NIH is doing some on this with what's called Buspirone. It's an antidepressant, but it relaxes the stomach. So we're kind of, we understand this is a problem of, some people call it accommodation, but it's that stomach won't accommodate the food because it's too contracted. So there are a few things you can try to reduce that pain. If the pain is from the pylorus, or at least that's part of the pain, you know, we try to pick the right patient for that. That's a tough one. That's another muscle spasm, and maybe the same things that relax the body and the corpus of the stomach might help relax the pylorus. But in those, I usually think those people with gastroparesis have a normal rhythm of the stomach. So it suggests there's some other pathophysiologic problem causing the delay in emptying. And that's where we do balloon dilation or Botox of the pylorus, trying to help that pain. But I think folks ought to really think about, is that pain I'm experiencing actually from my stomach? Because those are the two specific stomach neuromuscular problems that I go after from the stomach. You know, a lot of other things around the stomach that could be causing pain.
Well, that's all that information is so much appreciated and so necessary. As I always say, when patients are armed with knowledge, they're better equipped to make decisions for themselves, but also it helps them to educate others. Melissa, I'm going to turn this part over to you to ask the questions of the participants here.
Melissa? Yes. I'm sorry. I did not know that I was supposed to put a question in, and I just wonder if I can throw one quick question out.
Sure.
That I didn't mail to you. I wondered what the doctor felt about any kind of tie-ins between this kind of stomach ailment and dysautonomia, because I've got all these things that you've talked about for over 20 years, plus heart issues, blood pressure issues, body temperature control issues, all issues. Do you ever consider the pain and the gastric issues to be part of a grander scope like the dysautonomia?
Yes, we surely do. And one of our
Dr. Cook, we lost you.
Oh. How's that? Is that better?
Oh, yes. Okay. Welcome back.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah. It had fluttered or mute for some reason automatically. That's a great question, because about 10 years ago, one of our pediatric gastroenterologists got me interested in what he was seeing, and that is a lot of children with POTS, you know, postural orthostatic tachycardia syndrome. Perhaps that's what you have, or it's one of the autonomic disturbances. And his patients, he's a gastro, so they were coming into him with nausea, but they'd also talk about fainting. And he found that many of these kids had POTS and that they had stomach dysrhythmias. They did have GI components. It wasn't just a fainting issue. And so, I don't know, a few years ago, we looked at, you know, in my population, I always ask patients who are with the symptoms of gastroparesis, do you get lightheaded? You know, when you stand up, do you feel faint? And I don't mean when you're dehydrated. I mean, when you're well hydrated, you get this lightheadedness thing. And we'll do a fair amount of tilt table tests. So the bottom line is, yes, I think a number, and I think it's about, we found a lot of POTS, maybe 1 out of 5 or 1 out of 6 of our gastroparesis patients. You got to do a tilt table test. But if you find it, the vascular, the cardiologists have their approach to that. But to your point, I do believe at a higher level of autonomic nervous system control, some folks with these GI symptoms, you know, that there is a problem with more central headquarters. Headquarters has a problem. And it's coming down and affecting the GI tract. And I often say, well, I get it. I understand that. But, you know, I can't fix, you know, the medulla oblongata. I can't tinker with your, I can't tinker with your brain. But we can try to help, you know, GERD. We can understand you've got, you know, this dysrhythmia or that gastric emptying, you know. So I say, I get it, I understand it, and I do think it's related, but it still leaves me with the tools that I have for the GI tract. The cardiologists do their best, but yes, that is something to be considered as bringing both things together.
Well, thank you for bringing that up. I have my tilt table test next week, and I pass out a lot and have many other things, and they have now finally are tying it together. But like you said, you have to work with fixing your area.
Yes. Yeah.
And okay. Thank you so much for answering that.
Yes. Okay.
So, Dr. Cook, one question that we had submitted, and you've kind of touched on this, but just to make sure, can gastroparesis cause pain below the stomach, like the mid to lower abdomen, or is it always strictly just confined to the stomach if it's truly from gastroparesis?
Yeah, that's a good question, and because this is why the GI tract is tricky, by the way, because pain is always referred. We call about referred pain. It's not like when I hit my thumb with the hammer, I know exactly where the pain's coming from. It's coming from my thumb. It's very, very specific. GI tract, very diffuse. So we think of the stomach, yes, between the belly button and, you know, the middle of the abdomen up to where your chest begins. But it can be to the left of that, can be to the right of that. When you start getting below the belly button, I get a little more doubtful that the pain and discomfort is from the stomach, because it's getting a little low, even for this vague referred pain. Like around the belly button, people think of the small bowel pain gets referred there. Colonic pain, you know, can be right, left. Colonic pain could be anywhere, right, left, up, down. So when you're starting to get down, you know, between the belly button and down to what we call the suprapubic area, that's to me getting a little low, and I start asking about colon function. Are you having pellet-like stools, irritable bowel type symptoms? So that's getting a little low for me in general to think about the stomach.
You also touched on this just a little bit, but you mentioned patients that sometimes have pain that you might describe as a Charlie horse, something like you would feel in your leg or your foot, that kind of cramp. Can you talk a little bit about what that might be or the causes of that?
Yeah, so all of the stomach, the small bowel, the colon, these are muscular tubes. And then the sphincters, you know, are hollow tubes, but the muscle's even stronger. It's even thicker. And so these muscles, they're not like the muscles, you know, that give you a Charlie horse, but they're close. You know, your GI tract has different kinds of contractions and relaxations, contraction, relaxation. And it's all coordinated to mix and empty food, or to move what's come from the stomach down the small bowel, or those contractions, relaxations must move the stool around the colon, you know. And so you need to think of it as a muscle. And so a muscle that's out of control can either spasm down and become tight, or it can really bloat up and dilate and become, you know, distended. It's like those are the two, you know, the two things that can go wrong, if you will. And so some people have more distension kind of pain, and others just say, oh my gosh, it is like a fist in there. It's like a Charlie horse. And that can happen anywhere. It can be in the sigmoid colon. It could happen in the small bowel somewhere. The pylorus I mentioned. These are spasm pains that, you know, depending on where they are, depending on the PQRST, might help you understand where they're coming from in terms of location, in terms of organ.
Yes. Okay. Thank you. Before I go back to the questions that are submitted, is there anyone on the call today that has a question that you would like to ask?
Yes, this is Ishania. I just want the doctor to say medulla oblongata.
Yeah, well, that's a fun one. Medulla oblongata. It probably it'd be a great name for a rock group.
I just wanted to say thank you so much, doctor. I recently started Flexerel, so now I understand why Flexerel has been my miracle drug for me and the gastroparesis. So thank you so much for your information today.
Where was your pain, by the way?
My pain is all over. I get a tenderness to my guts and to my stomach when I eat.
Okay.
It's all through my system, the tenderness. So I'm sure that's an inflammation because my muscles are trying to work and they just don't want to. Or they're working too much, I should say.
Yeah. Do you have scars on your abdomen too?
No, I do not. So that's kind of what threw me off. I get my pain right at that sphincter of my stomach and my esophagus where it meets. I get a lot of bloating there, a lot of pain there.
Okay. Yeah.
And then all through my guts. It's just tender to the touch.
Yeah. Well, that's, you know, I mean, so that's great. The doctor tried something a little different, and sometimes we just try things and you hit the bullet on, you know, that was what was driving your pain and found a medicine. So thank you for sharing that.
Well, he finally gave me a diagnosis of dystonia. And because I have a mild case of dystonia, he put it all together and tried me on the Flexerel. So that's what worked for me.
Okay. Right.
I do have a question if you don't mind.
What's your first name?
Darcy.
Hi, Miss Darcy. Go ahead.
Okay, so I had a gastric emptying study probably about 5 years ago, and it had showed like 40%, I think, after 4 hours. Is it possible for a gastric emptying study to improve after a number of years?
Yes, and this is not really well known yet, but with the NIH Gastroparesis Consortium, the paper's under review, and you know, we have like 400 patients with gastroparesis. And in one of our studies, we had people come back 1 year later and repeat the gastric emptying study. Nobody had done that before. You know, it was to be repeated. And kind of surprising, I think, 40% of those patients who had delayed emptying now had normal emptying. So I think especially if you have idiopathic gastroparesis, we don't know why you got it. The body's always trying to heal itself 24/7. It's trying to get better. So I think in some patients, you know, it will improve the gastric emptying. Now, the really interesting thing is those patients who had better emptying didn't always feel better. And that is beginning to tell us there are other mechanisms causing the symptoms, mechanisms we're just beginning to understand better, mechanisms like the dysrhythmia and the poor stomach relaxation. So I think we're going to make some progress now. And you know, you don't blame every symptom on the delay. There are other factors. But in terms of the emptying, yes, I've seen it. Many people have seen people normalize their gastric emptying over time.
Doctor, can I throw one last one in? These symptoms that we've talked about from everybody, mine is more like a burning soup can in my right upper quadrant that can radiate towards my back. But sometimes I can eat with no problem. Sometimes I can eat and I'm in horrible, miserable agony. Is it common that you see that people can one day be okay, the next day fall apart, and these things be like, oh, I've had a really good month of that, and now I'm suffering for a few months? Is that normal?
Yeah, I usually don't see that kind of, you know, you're good for 3 or 4 months and then it kicks in. And especially if it's a pain syndrome, like you described, you might, you know, it may be another mechanism that you have to look at. But you know, if you've really got like that gastroparesis of a chronic continuing kind, you know, you don't get those days and weeks off. So I sometimes say, wow, if you have normal emptying and you're doing great for weeks, and then something hits, you got to go back and try to figure out what is very hard. What did I do different? Is this a pain syndrome that's episodic and that can be hard. So that would be a little unusual, you know, and because it is, that would be unusual. Still got to find what's triggering it.
Hi, Melissa, it's Debbie. I'd like to ask a question if I can.
Okay.
So I have gastroparesis. I had colonic inertia. I've had the G-palm, and I've also have a permanent ileostomy. And I'm still not all the time, and I can't figure out exactly why, but the same pain that I've had since before the G-palm and the ileostomy, where I get this rock hard pressure pain in my sternum. And
in
I
your
do
sternum, have, I'm sorry, in your that's in your chest.
Yeah, it's right at the very top of the rib cage. So I guess that's the sternum.
Yeah.
Right below that where the ribs meet. And yeah. I do have a hiatal hernia, but they say it's small. I have esophageal issues and I have no gallbladder.
Okay.
I can't figure out like what causes it. You know, I'm really good about journaling my food and stuff like that. It just, it's so bad sometimes that it takes your breath away.
Yeah.
Ulcer maybe?
Well, but it's right down at the bottom of your breastbone. It's right at the
yes.
bottom of your breast, right?
Yes.
Can you put one finger on it?
Probably.
Where it hurts, I mean.
Probably two fingers.
Yeah. But if you press real hard there, will it hurt?
It actually gives me relief when I press on it.
Yeah. Well, I have had a couple patients like that. And, you know, that, yeah, they've done endoscopy, so they know it's not an ulcer.
Right.
Does food hurt it or does movement hurt it?
Food. Definitely associated with eating.
How about coughing, turning, jumping?
No.
Yeah. Well, you know, usually if you can put your finger on it and it really hurts, that's either a scar, which you don't have, but there's also a piece of cartilage right there. It's called the xiphoid. X-I-P-H-O-I-D. It's a piece of cartilage. I've had some people where that cartilage is actually inflamed and it gets overlooked as, you know, a cause of pain right there. If it's kind of localized, there are not that many things right there. Your xiphoid, then some muscle, some tendon, and then you're getting into the esophagus behind there.
Isn't there a ligament right there that can slip?
Well, back in there, then your diaphragm comes in there, then your esophagus goes through there. So, you know, there's a number of things, but if anybody's operated up in that area, you know, there can be scar tissue too. So sometimes those are folks I have, you know, see the pain clinic and say, we can't figure out what it is. Yeah, CAT scan's normal, endoscopy's normal. None of these other things helped. So just fix it. I just have people go to the pain clinic, just get rid of the pain, whatever it takes. But the xiphoid, that's also where that xiphoid cartilage is. So there's some ideas for you.
Thank you.
Okay, can I say one thing about the pain clinic? I've noticed a couple references to going to a pain clinic.
Very quick, very quickly, because we're really out of time.
Okay. I've been to the UNC pain clinic, and I've been to several others, and they say we can't help you with digestive pain issues.
We'll make this. I'll comment on that. So many, many pain doctors, they love to take care of neck pain. They love to take care of spinal pain. They don't really have any interest or even know what to do.
For those of you who have missed any of the other programs that Dr. Cook has done for us, they can be found, the audio can be found on our website at agmdhope.org. Dr. Cook, you are appreciated more than you'll ever realize. We're so incredibly grateful for all your time, your dedication, and your commitment to patients, their families, to AGMD, and for providing such hope for the future for all of us impacted by gastroparesis. I just want to thank you so much for being such an incredible inspiration.
Thank you, Doctor.
And Melissa, thank you for all you do for the gastroparesis community and for AGMD, taking care of the questions there. Your care, compassion, and heart shine through and everything that you do. And for all of you suffering with gastroparesis, as I always say, you are my heroes, because
thank you, Marian,
are the quiet ones that go through this every single day. And Dr. Cook has been so gracious in beginning in January. He will be talking with us every other month. So we're calling it Conversations with Dr. Cook. Again, thank you so much. And I hope that you all have a blessed Thanksgiving and a blessed day.
Happy Thanksgiving. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Thank you.